So now we're going to go to a question period. While we're having your questions, and actually while we set up the mic so we can have questions, we're going to pass the hat for donations. Starting, I think, over here, we have a hat. Great.
Les partants qui arrivent du Charaz. La raison que je suis dérangé, c'est parce que je sais que Charaz a pris une position contre la guerre en Irak. Mais en même temps, à la France, il y a une politique incroyable contre les immigrants, les Arabes, etc. Même si on pense que Charaz est en train de faire de la fin, c'est que les fachos, on en croise les fachos avec Charaz. Alors je veux que toi, tu complémentes ce que Racha a dit vis-à-vis. Qu'est-ce qui se passe sur le politique domestique à la France vis-à-vis des immigrants, les sans-statuts
Je pense que non. Je pense que très, ouais, c'était très dur.
Je te rassure, dans les manifestations, il n'y avait pas de drapeau bleu-blanc-rouge pour Chirac. Il y a plutôt des drapeaux noirs et rouges, ou même des drapeaux rouges anti-Chirac. En France, oui, en France. Hein, mais on a vu aussi, nous aussi, on a été surpris de voir à New York aussi, ou en Angleterre, certaines pancartes disaient vive Chirac, vive la France. Moi, ça m'a... Nous, on était un peu, un peu surpris. La situation des immigrés en France est exactement celle que la camarade a décrit. C'est-à-dire que depuis des années, mais ça ne date pas de Chirac, ça date depuis pratiquement 20 ans, depuis les premiers gouvernements de gauche, où les immigrés servent de bouc émissaire à la dégradation de la situation sociale. Plus la situation sociale empire, plus la misère augmente, plus un gouvernement, quel qu'il soit, a besoin d'un bouc émissaire pour détourner l'attention sur les vrais problèmes. Il y a quelques années, on avait sorti une affiche qui avait ces quelques mots. Plus il y a de misère, plus on vote des lois contre les immigrés. Hein? Aujourd'hui, il y a des camps de rétention, on met de force des immigrés dans des charters à destination de l'Afrique. Il y a des rafles. J'en parlerai demain, par exemple, par rapport à la lutte sur les transports gratuits que l'on mène, parce que justement c'est extrêmement lié. Par exemple, à Paris ou dans les grandes villes en France, la majorité des gens qui sont sans papier, qui sont clandestins, se font ramasser justement pendant les contrôles de transport. Et c'est justement un des liens que l'on fait avec la lutte des sans-papiers, c'est qu'en demandant et en exigeant des transports gratuits pour tous, c'est-à-dire le fait de ne pas être contrôlé, de pouvoir circuler librement. Donc en fait, en France, très clairement, on a dénoncé la militarisation et la criminalisation du mouvement social et de la misère. Hein. Ça, c'est très clair. On a fait très, très rapidement le parallèle. Donc, je ne sais pas si j'ai répondu. Par contre, moi, je voudrais réagir par rapport à ce qu'a dit la dernière copine du Vermont. Je vais peut-être choquer l'assistance. Mais dans notre tête, quand on a commencé la campagne sur le problème de la guerre en Irak qui s'annonçait, on savait très bien qu'on n'allait pas arrêter la guerre. Et on savait très bien Nous, on avait parfaitement analysé que, de toute façon, s'ils avaient décidé d'aller en Irak, ils iraient. La copine a parlé d'opération de police, je suis un peu d'accord avec elle. Et nous, toute notre propagande, c'était pas de faire une propagande pour faire croire aux gens qu'on allait absolument arrêter la guerre et que si on l'arrêtait pas, c'était un échec. Hein? Je pense que justement, alors on mobilisait effectivement contre la guerre, mais pour nous, le fait de ne pas avoir arrêté la guerre n'est pas forcément un échec. Ce qui serait un échec, c'est qu'effectivement, tout ce qui s'est passé pendant la campagne anti-guerre, comme elle l'a dit, soit évaporé. Si effectivement tout ce qu'on j'ai dit tout à l'heure sur contre le nationalisme, contre l'antimilitarisme et contre le capitalisme s'est évaporé et il ne reste plus rien, alors effectivement c'est un échec. Mais l'échec ou la réussite du mouvement ne se situe pas, de mon point de vue, en fait, par rapport au fait qu'il y ait eu la guerre ou pas la guerre. Par exemple, depuis 5 ans, quels sont, dans les manifestations, on a beaucoup de rencontrés de gens nouveaux, effectivement. Hein, après Seattle, après tous ces mouvements-là. Il y a eu effectivement une apparition nouvelle du mouvement anarchiste. Quelle est la question qu'on nous pose le plus souvent? C'est pas qu'est-ce que vous pensez de, mais c'est qu'est-ce que vous faites, qu'est-ce que vous proposez concrètement pour moi, pour aujourd'hui, mettre en place des pratiques en rupture avec le capitalisme et avec l'État. Et toute notre propagande, que ce soit une propagande écrite, parce qu'on en a besoin quand même. Des livres, on a besoin des livres. Et on a besoin de combattre au niveau de l'idéologie. Mais toute notre propagande se situe sur le fait que les pratiques que l'on met en place aujourd'hui doivent être des pratiques qui préfigurent la société que nous proposons. Et c'est comme ça que nous arriverons à faire prendre position les gens pour qu'effectivement, dans la tête des gens, un déclic se fait pour que dire oui, c'est possible, on peut dire non, et deux, oui, c'est possible, on peut construire aujourd'hui et maintenant autre chose.
Des autres questions, commentaires, other questions or comments?
Hey, so this question's for Ashanti, and I was wondering, you talked about community organizing and going into communities and doing less like flyering and more interaction, like you were talking about with the Panthers did. And I was wondering, I think a lot of people are afraid to go into the communities because of the fact that, like you said, sexism, racism exists in those communities, which is makes up the majority of society. But I wonder what you, if you had any strategies for dealing with, because I think the predominant way of bonding with people, in order, like you have to bond in order to gain trust to the people in the community, is at the expense of other people. Like I come from like a lower income area originally, and everybody kind of bonds over taking a piss out of one group or another in a racist, misogynist way, etc. And so it seems like there's like a disconnect in language, a way of communicating, so you don't have anything left to, like, what is there to do when you're going in and how do you bond with that community? And then the other question is about if you spend too much time in that community, I think people have a fear that they're going to lose the lessons that they've learned as activists. What would you say to those fears?
Okay. I'm not sure the whole before, because I'm not sure if I understand the second one. Go over the second one again.
Well, the second one is that if you became involved in the community heavily and spent a lot of time working in the community, that you would become kind of caught up in the gist or the just the way that the community works, like kind of going back into that sort of, you know, racist and misogynist milieu and get, like, you know, disappear and back into it again. Because that's, like, where a lot of people already have come from, you know, like...
All right. I think that I think what worked for me was that, especially I guess in the time of the Black Panther Party, was that I didn't work alone. You know, so I mean, you're going in the community to build relationships, and it's not just you, but your group. And we always had mentors, you know. I call mentors today, but they would be, like I'm from New Jersey, small town in New Jersey, so there would be Panthers would come from New York to show us pretty much how to be Panthers. And being Panthers meant that you learned how to work with people in the community. So we would go with them, and we would actually just go and meet people. And they were people who I knew because I grew up in the community. But now I'm learning how to hold conversations with them around political issues, which I didn't know, you know. And it helped a lot that I had some others more experienced who knew how, and could pretty much walk me through it. That worked for me, and I think it can work for us. It's just, for example, like, there's always veteran activists, veteran anarchists, veteran revolutionaries around who may not be active today, but maybe that's one way we can draw on them. It's like to kind of show us what those strengths were that we had back in them days, you know, that helped us to build relationships. I think on the other one, it sounds more like, it made me think of me being in the men's group and how easy it is for us in the men's group to like last for maybe a month or two, and then the group folds, and we back to doing our regular shit, you know, which is being sexist men, you know? Because if you're not constantly working on it, you pretty much drift back to what you used to doing, you know? So again, it's like that thing, if you got community, you got people who are, you're going to actually help each other. You're going to kind of get each other's back. You know that people are going to slip at times. We're not perfect. I think being a sexist is a big addiction, you know? So it's like if you don't keep working on that addiction, it comes back. You know, community helps. And it just helps to keep us focused on our goal, and it helps us to just keep trying to like build up strength so that we don't keep going back to old habits that just tend to frustrate, you know, our best intentions, you know? So on the one level, I mean, it's like, if you got people that can help you learn how to actually break down being alienated from other people, that helps. If you don't, then you do your best thing. You take your best shot and see how you do, and you learn from your mistakes. Because what we used to say in back then, too, was that it's better to do and fail than to just sit back and theorizing all day about how you might fail. Take your best shot, you know, and learn how to dialogue with people. And dialogue, I mean, I stress dialogue, that's back and forth. It's just not you with our sometimes superior thinking. Thinking is superior. That we just want to educate the people. You know, it's not really about that. It's really about an honest sharing of what you know with what they know, and where can we meet. Because we're really not separate from the people. We are just as much oppressed as the people. We are the people. You know, we just happen to be doing some different stuff. You know, and so I think those things happen, but I think community helps. If groups help, where we can back each other, we need that a lot. I think a lot of the reason why we're not able to move forward is less to do with what the state does than what we do to each other.
Je vais intervenir en français. Je pense qu'il y a des choses, des fois aussi, puis ça, je suis assez d'accord avec ce que Ashanti a dit, non, surtout vers la fin, c'est que souvent j'entends ce mot-là d'aller dans les communautés, puis c'est comme si on était parachuté comme par avion dans une communauté inconnue. Ben, je veux dire, je pense pas que la part du monde ici pense ça, mais il faut faire attention à ce langage-là, souvent parce qu'on est dans une communauté, on vit dans un quartier, on travaille des endroits, on organise dans certains contextes. On a des amis de la famille, du monde qu'on rencontre dans la rue. Ça, c'est notre contexte direct dans lequel qu'on peut organiser face à notre propre vie. Puis c'est ça, on est le quand on dit le monde, le peuple. Ben, on fait partie de ça, on n'est pas externe à ça, on n'est pas une bébite d'une autre planète qui descend, les anarchistes d'une autre planète, puis qui viennent organiser les autres. C'est que je pense que ça, c'est important, puis c'est important d'interagir avec les gens face à qu'est-ce qui se passe. Puis je vais juste donner un exemple, parce que moi aussi j'avais des papillons, puis j'ai pas écouté, j'ai pas fait ce que HNT a fait, j'aurais-tu le faire, puis je parlais en premier, mais une affaire qui est importante, c'est que quand on interagissait, quand on passait de la propagande, entre autres, dans les manifs, on parle plus ça de la propagande, c'est notre perspective, Mais il faut interagir avec les gens. Il ne faut pas juste passer une affaire comme si c'était plate à lire. Puis entre autres aussi, en tant qu'anarchiste, nous, on a eu des élections. En plus, il y avait plein de partis. Les gentils de l'UFP, en parenthèse, là, qui essayaient d'aller chercher le vote du mouvement anti-guerre autant que le Bloc pot. C'est qu'on était une manif anti-guerre où ce que... Que l'UFP qui passe un pamphlet qui dit « Venez entendre la position de l'UFP sur, en, contre la guerre. » Puis j'ai posé une question à quelqu'un, c'est-tu vraiment ça ou vous essayez d'aller chercher des votes? Et il dit « Non, non, c'est vraiment, on va parler de la perspective de la guerre. » Quand quelqu'un d'autre juste à côté disait « Venez rencontrer les candidats de l'UFP à notre événement public. » Ça fait bon, il y avait toute cette perspective-là de vote et en tant qu'anarchiste, une perspective anti-vote. Ben, c'est important, puis on a passé nos pamphlets en disant, parce qu'en même temps, tout le monde leur courait après pour des, n'importe quelle partie. Fait que nous, on a dit, aussi une perspective libertaire, communiste, anarchiste, sur la guerre, puis on veut pas votre vote. Ce qu'on veut, c'est que vous preniez le pamphlet, puis vous lisez, puis vous interagissez avec nous autres, mais on veut pas votre vote. Puis c'était drôle, parce que la part du monde, il y a tout le temps ce feeling-là que tout le monde essaie d'avoir quelque chose d'eux autres. Nous, on veut rien du monde. Ce qu'on veut, c'est interagir avec eux, puis c'est partir dans nos communautés, puis lutter. Puis ça, je pense que c'est quelque chose de positif. Puis une dernière affaire qui est importante aussi, c'est qu'on n'a peut-être pas arrêté cette guerre-là, puis on n'arrêtera pas la guerre parce que c'est une guerre sociale, comme plein de monde l'imaginait, à plein de niveaux, qui inclut la guerre militaire, plus classique. Mais il y a des choses quand même assez gênantes, puis plusieurs parties dans le monde ont les plus grosses mobilisations qu'ils ont jamais eues dans les 20 dernières années, les plus grosses mobilisations de leur histoire. Il y a eu, aux États-Unis, le mouvement syndical, à la base, n'a jamais mobilisé tant que ça pour la guerre. C'était une surprise pour plein de monde, même les gens qui se disent comme moi de la lutte de classe, puis qu'on veut. C'était une surprise étonnante, puis c'est quand même des bons signes. Il y a des communautés au complet, il y a eu des bons feelings quand même face à ça. Il y a eu certains problèmes, on est loin de gagner, on est loin d'arriver à ce que ça soit comme on le voit. Mais c'est déjà une voie, puis il faut continuer. Puis je pense que ce travail-là se fait dans un travail, comme on a parlé, qui est impliqué dans nos communautés. Qu'on arrête de parler comme si des autres, qu'on était sur une autre planète, mais qu'on est vraiment, qu'on fait partie de cette communauté-là, puis qu'on va lutter en tant qu'anarchiste en étant honnête, mais qu'on verra pas comme le reste du monde comme étant stupide, mais comme du monde qui ont des réalités similaires à les nôtres, qu'on va interagir avec, qui ont des différences aussi, mais qu'on va interagir ces différences-là au lieu de mettre le monde à part et dire « Ah, oh, c'est ça, il y a une part d'aller souvent dans nos propres quartiers, dans nos propres lieux de travail. Il y a plein d'anarchistes anonymes qui parlent jamais à le monde à qui ils travaillent, qui sont anarchistes, puis que dans le fond, en tout cas, dans le fond, c'est ça, c'est d'interagir, puis c'est d'enfin de sortir de l'anonymat, puis de commencer à interagir avec le monde. »
I'm just going to answer that really quickly. I think that's something that I was actually trying to talk about too, that in terms of what you're saying, that if you're going to go into a community and try to organize, but then you're going to get frustrated and bogged down with sexism, heterosexism, or racism within a community, I think that's not fair at all, because it somehow assumes that community organizing is somehow more racist and sexist and homophobic than collectives that we organize in, and that somehow, even though we have the rhetoric, we have our shit down, which we don't, you know. We may not say the kind of shit that other people may say, but people are really no different than, you know, so-called community organizing that we're talking about. So I don't think it's fair to say that. I think, as Ashanti was saying, we are the people, we are these communities, and unless it is a learning process, and unless we don't change those dynamics within communities and within our collectives ourselves, then we cannot pass the blame off, because that exists no matter what collective you're organizing, no matter what community you're organizing with. And when you're talking about getting bogged down in the dynamics of those communities, again, it's something that, I don't know if Sarita's here, but she says that in Nona's Legal a lot, in terms of when we do community organizing, is that you lead by following and you follow by leading. I don't know if she's here, but Sarita says that. And it's true, right? Like, it's a process of mutual learning, and that has to happen. Otherwise, it's not really fair to pass the buck off to a community and somehow deem it somehow more frustrating than working in a collective. It's not fair at all.
I think we have time for one or two more questions. Il y a du temps pour une, peut-être deux interventions.
I wanted to put a little different spin on the community thing. I'm from Chicago, and
Chicago 15 000 personnes après que la guerre a commencé en prison.
C'était spontané.
On ne savait pas qu'est-ce qu'on faisait avant que ça arrivait.
But at the same time, it was a really empowering experience, but it raised a lot of questions for a lot of us who have been doing a lot of anti-war work, especially in the community, in the inner scene in Chicago, and in different more working class communities here in Chicago, because the bulk of that 10,000 to 15,000 people were middle to upper class white folks from the north side of Chicago. And I think what happened was these are the people who had called their congressmen and they called the White House and they'd done all the things they've been told, you know, these things work for people like us. And it had worked for them. And that was like a huge thing. And they were pissed. And so they took out for anger on one night and then, you know, the next 3 nights happened and then they were announced maybe like the same 3,000 people that were there before February 15th or whatever, you know? And I think it shows sort of the limitations of that because people who weren't at that 15,000 person demo the night after the war started were people who already had a vision of them as having been disenfranchised from the like the regular political process. And so what I thought was even more inspiring than that 15,000 people taking the freeway were a series of significantly smaller demonstrations that happened in communities all over Chicago. A bunch of us in the neighborhood collective there has a large Mexican participation. Set up a small rally of 200 people in one of the two big Mexican communities in Chicago. On February 15th, the day of all the worldwide rallies, that rally was held in a largely Indian and Mexican community on the north side. And I think those sorts of events were significantly more powerful in the long run than 15,000 people having a great time for one night showing down the street. So I think it's really important to maintain that kind of emphasis. But at the same time, the trick is trying to figure out how to make those small rallies in those communities feel as empowering to the people who participate in them as 15,000 people felt empowered showing up like their drive. I don't know if anyone on this panel has suggestions on a smaller scale where you have a lot more limitations actively and especially in communities like in Chicago or Montgomery, where lots of immigrants who are often unable to take risks like taking a movie.
It's not exactly the same because but Vermont is such a funny place because it's so tiny already. And one thing that a group called American Friends Service, which are some Quakers, they basically sort of were kind of, there's one guy in particular who gets paid to organize activism, and anytime, anything, every day would go, are we supposed to go in the streets today? Everyone would turn to that guy because he was paid and he had an office and none of the rest of us did. But he actually did this thing where he organized a people's assembly for the day after the war was supposed to start, and something like 300 people went to it, but people just talked to each other and passed some resolutions that they were putting out to each other and to the world, and it was so amazing because it was exactly, I was really struck by that, because there was about 10 of us who were anarchists, or maybe 20 of us, and a lot of us actually didn't even know each other, met there, which is really funny, but it was the people who had called their senators who were the most radical in terms of the language for resolutions. So some of my anarchist friends would say, oh, we should say that we condemn the Bush administration, you know, and then someone, a liberal, stood up and said, no, we should condemn governments in general because governments do this, and we're all like, wow, okay, you know. It was those people. It was really shocking. And so my collective said, well, this is, and we were also really inspired by what's been happening in Argentina, which people taking directly democratic control of their resistance. So we volunteered at the end of this assembly to organize a second one, and the Quakers had called it a People's Assembly for Peace, and we just passed resolutions, and we called it a People's Assembly for Resistance, and we actually made the mistake of having a table like this to facilitate the meeting, but we said, okay, so what do people want to do to resist in our own community? And everybody kept looking to us for like 10 minutes, well, what should we do? What do you want us to do? And we're like, well, we're just facilitating this. And after like 10 minutes, everybody got it. And people just started throwing out ideas they wanted to do. And people took, it was the most neat thing I went to during all the anti-war stuff, because everybody got really excited about the own ways they wanted to resist. And they decided not to call American Friends Service anymore and took on issues they were concerned about. And 9 sort of working groups came out, people split up into groups and started talking, and then actually several projects came out of that. But I thought that was a way to make it was like 50 or 100 people that showed up at that second one, but it was so empowering because people actually took power over their resistance from that. Unfortunately, you know, I mean, some of the projects are still going on, 2 and 3 people, but, you know, some people were mad that American flags were up in their town, so they went to do a campaign to get the American flags down, and other people were upset about social service cuts, you know, but in a way, I think we have to allow ourselves and others to self-determine our forms of resistance, not just end up in a street together and wonder how we got there because someone called it a demonstration, which isn't very empowering either. So,
I had just thought of one thing, and maybe it's in this line. Me and my partner, we were invited to an Anti-Columbus Day activity in Denver this past one. And it was real. I mean, this thing was so powerful, so moving. War Churchill and the Native American communities, the anarchist who have this really great relationship, the workers, you had the syndicalists, the wobblies, they was also involved. You had the black activists, and you had the Chicano groups. They planned this thing. I mean, they planned this thing so well. It was just so nice. But there was this place right at near the Capitol where the streets converged in like 4 different directions. In fact, the thing was called 4 Directions. And the Native Americans came from the west. The Chicanos came from the south. The African Americans came from the east, and the anarchists came from, what direction is left?
No,
the north. No. All right, it's something like that. I may have some of that wrong, right? But it was so powerful, and a lot of it centered. A big part of it was the drum, and you know how we are. When we go to something, the anarchists have these drums. They grab up anything and becomes a drum. All right. So the Native Americans have their drums, and the people of African descent have theirs. So there was everybody had their drum. But when you looked up, you seen Native Americans in their native dress coming from like this way. You had the anarchists coming from this way. You had the blacks coming from that way, and you had the other group. The Chicano groups coming. If you could have saw it, it was such a powerful. It was a powerful thing to see everybody converge in this one spot. And when they got there, all the drummers got into the center, and the indigenous people and the Chicanos did a ceremony. But then after that point, there was like 8 areas right around there, from the federal building to the local police department to a few other places. But there was all these local issues that were peculiar to each individual community. There was a number of killings by the police, so that there was a Chicano group went down to the police station. There was, for Leonard Pelcher, they went down to the federal building. And I forget where the other groups went, but it allowed each group to focus on their individual issues. And it was a really powerful thing. But even the whole thing was to shut down the Columbus Day parade. But it gave me an idea of like how that could happen, you know, and how we could use, you know, what was part of our cultures and what's our common issues to try to find some ways to work together. And that's the closest that I have seen toward that. And since we saw that, it's like, can we do this in New York? You know, and actually that's where we at now. We want to see if we can do something like that in New York. But it did allow for small groups to participate in something powerful like that, but also to do other things that focus particularly on issues that was really close to them.
I'm just going to say really quickly, Cass is speaking tomorrow, which is the non-status Algerians in Montreal, and they'll definitely have a lot to say about how they've self-determined their direction and nature of resistance for over a year now. So if you're interested, you should come listen to them.
Okay, we have time for one last question. Est-ce qu'il y a une dernière question?
The Spanish translator can't hear you.
You know, it really troubles me when people support this war because they say, you know, we don't live in a time anymore where we can be complacent in the oppressions of others, you know, because it's exactly the kinds of things that we in this movement, in the anarchist movement, in the anti-globalization movement say. And I think that it leaves me feeling a little bit like these rhetorical tools are meaningless, that these words are losing their meaning, and I feel very silenced by that. You know, how do we talk about human rights when human, you know, the idea of human rights is being used to legitimize, you know, imperialist invasions in Iraq. So I'm just wondering if you have any ideas about how we can reappropriate the language or explode the language and reinstill it with more meaning or whatever.
I'll answer that one in English, I guess. I didn't do it yet, so I'll do it for that one. In terms of language, I think, and I might not answer especially what you're asking, but it's something that sparked in the whole war, like, I think this is where actually anarchists have to bring sometimes a lot into the interaction we have with the anti-war movement and also against, you know, the state and the bosses. And it's our perspective have to be rooted in a really anti-nationalist, anti-patriotic perspective. And this is what they try to create. Us, that is, the Quebecois, the Canadian, the American. And this is basically, this is how they justify that our enemies end up being a whole people somewhere else. And basically, our perspective have to be internationalist. We have to be clear that the people they're bombing in Iraq, like, are not our enemies, but are the people who have a parallel and similar in the same reality in a lot of cases that a lot of our communities are here, and that the so-called, like, people who represent us, our bosses, the Bill Gates and the George W. and the Pedado and all these other, like, exploiters who live on, you know, are associated with our nation, are like, we have to basically use the language in which we're saying we have to break the us in terms of that, you know, nation. And the same thing with people here use. A lot of people, and, you know, including people in the area I live, use the Americans. Oh, it's the Americans. The Americans are crazy. Well, wait a second, you know, it's not all the Americans. Most Americans don't want that war. Most Americans are living in extreme poverty. Most Americans have a really similar reality that a lot of people are, you know, like the working class in Ireland. Obviously, there's huge difference at that time that they were being bombed, but obviously, like, the level of poverty can be different, but, you know, the reality is they have us, they have a state that rule over them, and there's an international, like, ruling class who basically benefit from those wars, benefit from the exploitation, benefit from the social war that have been waged on, you know, on everyone, on all over the planet, and we have to basically try to bring a really internationalist perspective in which we develop a way in which we support people and their own ways of organizing, but we try also to say that, you know, these people are you know, they're fighting, we're fighting in common, or fight is common. So basically, I mean, that's the level of language. The other level of language, I'm not sure, because in general, I tend to avoid listening to the media a lot, and I try to basically approach people by what they live in their neighborhood and what they see that war and what they see out of that war, and also try to bring an anarchist perspective into that, and basically, you know, as a group too, and personally, a class war perspective, and saying, you know, like the war that the yuppies are bringing gentrification in your neighborhood, and that the boss are locking out workers, is in the same war that George W. Bush is bombing Iraq. And here are the links, and basically try to make the links and interact with people and say how you live it and how other people live it, but it's all linked together.
I also think part of it is the number one anarchist although people have been talking about great propaganda here, I think by and large anarchists do a lot of praxis and projects and spend less time thinking about writing. And what my collective actually debated a slogan on one of our banners for about 10 hours, because we were like, how can you say in 4 words a stance that relates war to capitalism, that describes what both are, and statecraft? And but it was such an interesting conversation, because we realized through the process of how easily we just throw out words like freedom or liberation or anti-war, but that those words mean so much for other, mean so many different things for people. So I think one thing is, in terms of language, is to listen and spend a lot of time on the streets talking to people and listening to what they have, what do they mean by freedom, what do they mean by security, what are they afraid of? And often the answer isn't what you think it will be. I always have a knee-jerk reaction to seeing the American flag or the support the troops or yellow ribbons, but when you actually ask people what it means to them, it isn't always the answer you think you'll get. So I think that's the first thing. And the second thing is, I think we have to be really careful not to take on sort of the mirror opposite of what the mainstream media says, or even listen to the mainstream media perhaps. But when we write, I think it's so easy to throw out things that we all know as shorthand. Well, when we talk about freedom, we know what it means. You know, anarchists know what freedom is, it's different. But I think it behooves us to start trying to explain what we mean by the word freedom, or mutual aid, or cooperation, or how we understand capitalism, without using the sort of buzzwords that are so much easier to fall back on. Because cooperation, I mean, that's used, you know, by heads of state, by, you know, I mean, when people that are part of the World Economic Forum and heads of state like Chirac and all these other people can claim they're anti-war, when George Bush can say he's bringing freedom, you know, we really have to be able to describe substantially what we mean by those things. And it's really hard. I mean, it's a great exercise to sit down and actually try to, without using the words, describe what we would understand freedom to be. And that's only what we would understand freedom to be for the moment, and that would change over time. But I think it's really important for us as anarchists and anti-authoritarians not to sort of fall back on the rhetoric. And that's particularly hard in these kind of big demonstration kind of situations where you tend to do sort of slogans because you're at a demonstration and what are you gonna fit on a banner? But to try to spend time, spend time doing that. And the last thing is my collective ended up writing this little piece where we decided we would engage in the anti-war movement. So we basically wrote a piece looking at the phrase peace is patriotic, and we unpacked peace, and then we unpacked patriotism, and then we showed why neither were correct in the way people were using them in the anti-war movement, and intentionally handed it out to other people to create a dialogue, which we did. We got into lots of conversations and learned things that we'd said that weren't, you know, very good in the process of what we'd written. But part of it was we had a big debate in my collective about whether it was even useful to use certain words in writing. But in a way, we have to reclaim the word freedom. We can't let them take those words. We can't let them take the word democracy or cooperation. And so it isn't just enough to say I'm going to ignore the mainstream media or Bush's use of language and try to figure out other words to replace it, which, you know, okay, Bush is using freedom, we have to use something else. Well, no, we have to reclaim words, not just streets. And not just, you know, our communities, but we have to reclaim language too, so.